I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Consensus or Controversy, as tonight we talk about the management of hepatocellular cholangiocarcinoma and pancreatic cancer. We have an outstanding faculty tonight, Dr. Tony Saab from the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona, Dr. Kim Rice-Binder from the University of Pennsylvania Averson Cancer Center, Dr. Eileen O'Reilly from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Dr. Philip Phillip from the Karmanis Cancer Institute at Wayne State University. We also are doing our TikTok program here tonight. We have a bunch of one-minute videos. This is the second of a two-part series. Really, we envision this as a mini-update course. All eight of the faculty, I work with each one of them individually to record their presentations and a mini-interview. They present cases from their practice. We put that together with the replays of the two webinars. We're going to have a 10-hour mini-series. So for fellows who want to get up to speed or docs who want to spend some time really taking a deep dive into this, these presentations are generally really informative. They go through all the trials. Tonight, we're going to talk about taking care of patients. And here's where we're heading tonight. We're going to talk about HCC first, then pancreatic and the cholangiocarcinoma. These are actually the eight questions that we asked in our TikTok videos. We're going to show you one-minute videos of our docs talking about how they think through these issues, and they'll ask for our faculty to comment on it. It's just really a way to, you know, put on a program that has seven or eight faculty people. It's pretty hard to do all live, so we recorded them and bring them in by pre-produced video. We're also, before each one of these, going to chat a little bit about interdisciplinary care that kind of goes beyond the triad of medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, and surgeons, and talk a little bit about some of the other people involved with the care of these patients. And Eileen, we're going to talk about HCC and the trials and the data and sequencing and the questions that people have. But we're also curious about the issue of what other specialists are helpful in the management of patients with HCC. Who are some of the, you know, other types of specialists in your interdisciplinary team that's helpful in terms of HCC, Eileen?
Yes, hi. Thanks, Neil. So I think a key colleague is your friendly hepatologist for co-managing these patients, given that it's the paradigm of two diseases in one, right? The underlying chronic liver disease for a substantial subset of patients, along with managing the optimal oncologic part of the plan from oncology. So I think that's key. I think the other group of people that we work very closely with is our colleagues in interventional radiology, especially for patients with localized HCC, where we're considering a local versus systemic therapy or integrating over time a multidisciplinary approach to these patients. So multidisciplinary review and hepatology for HCC.
So we, of course, sent out a survey to the attendees or the registrants for this conference and asked you a bunch of questions that we also asked our faculty. We're going to show you your answers and the faculty's answers as well. But we also asked you, what are the questions that you'd like to ask the faculty? And I'm just going to show you some samples. We got a couple hundred questions, but I would say this is number one on their list, sequencing. We had tons and tons of questions. Of course, bringing in atezo-bev sort of upset the apple cart. I think this first question, you know, really summarizes all the second line FDA approvals are based on people who had sorafenib first line. So how do we take data and figure out how to treat patients after a Bev, Atezo, or Atezo Bev? And again, we got 50 different versions of that question. That is one of the most common questions. But we're going to start out with our TikTok group talking about first line therapy and also the issue of first line therapy based on hepatic function. And after this, I'm going to ask Philip to comment a little bit on what he hears his other colleagues talking about and how Philip thinks through first line therapy. But here's the collateral faculty, let's call them.
We're still using atezo-bev as my standard of care. We've had a lot of patients enroll here on the pembro and lenvatinib study, which we're really eager to see the results. I've been very impressed with the patients that I've put on that trial anecdotally.
Are you finding less use of hepatic-directed therapy now that you have atezo-bev?
I think so. Globally, yes. I think we are using systemic therapies more, and I expect we'll continue to do so.
What we do is in patients with the grade one varices, we put them on beta blockade, and then we treat these patients. If patients have a grade two or have had a history of bleeding, of course, then we would treat first the varices before we start.
How about first-line therapy in a patient with more compromised liver function?
We still, because of the clear benefit in these patients, we would give atezo-bev. If there are no other contraindications, we would still go for atezo-bev in child B7 patients. You have to treat the cancer, and you have to treat the sick liver and to follow the sick liver.
So, Philip, I should mention, too, another element we're trying to squeeze in here tonight is what we call chalk talk slides. The faculty in their presentation goes through all the data in minute detail, and then we said, okay, we want you to make one slide for tonight that summarizes all this that you can use. You know, like imagine you're walking down the hall making rounds, you see a, you know, chalkboard or, you know, kind of write up a bunch of comments. So we're going to start out with Philip on this issue of first-line therapy because you wrote, you put this together. Yeah. But Philip, can you comment in general on how you're thinking through first-line therapy and any of the thoughts of the other faculty that you want to respond to?
So basically, I agree that atezo-bev will be our standard of care at this point in time. I mean, there's no question that based on the results of the phase 3 trial, the comparison, we have impressive reduction in the size of the tumor, which is something we don't see much of it, except when you use liver-directed therapy. I would really like to make the statement that the Child's Pugh classification really is prognostic. It doesn't mean that we can't use a combination of atezo-bev in a situation where it's B7 or even B8. So that's something which I really have to stress. Granted, the clinical trial was done in patients who have favorable Child Pugh. One thing which I would be cautious of is treating someone with Child's Pugh C. I will never do that. The other question regarding the bleeding risk, if you look at the clinical trial, the bleeding wasn't really major. There weren't that many patients who had bleeding. So in someone who has a reasonably well-controlled situation in terms of the esophageal varices, I'm very comfortable in really going forward. And age doesn't really matter to me that much because, again, I treat GI cancers, and we've been giving patients who are in their 70s, 80s drugs like the bevacizumab and also the immune checkpoint inhibitors. So collectively, in my opinion, I would be not so concerned about the age. As that was one of the things that you asked, whether it's a consideration. Certainly, I will be looking at patients who have cardiovascular risk and other things that might preclude the use of an anti-VEGF treatment or patients who cannot get immunotherapy.
So I just want to pick up on one point that Philip commented on, and then Tony, I'm going to ask you for your thoughts also in terms of what the audience said. And this is the issue of age and Bev and age and slash atezo-bev. So audience, I want to know if you have, is there an age at which you stop using bevacizumab? So this is a question for you. We're going to put it up as a poll question. Do you have an age in 80, 85, where you do not use bevacizumab because it concerns the toxicity and therefore maybe would think twice or maybe not even use atezo-bev? So, Tony, the vast majority of the audience says no, they don't have an age, but a quarter says yes. I'm curious what your thoughts are. Also, from the poll of the audience, you can see they're totally on board with atezo first line. This is what we call a consensus. When we ask some people what they do, if they all do the same thing, we call it a consensus. We asked about Child's Pugh B, Tony, and the audience is still, we said B7. The audience is still on board with atezo-bev. The faculty in general is, but there are a few people who hesitate. We'll talk a little bit about that. So, Tony, again, any thoughts on these refinities, Bev based on age and Child Pugh B?
Yeah, so I'm not sure why age would matter with atezo-bev versus, frankly, all these oral agents have their challenges. Toxicity is no lesser, but I would even argue that as patients get older, they get more confused about the pills. It's even more predictable to actually do the IV. So I would argue that age should not be discriminator. I mean, there should be other factors that help guide our decision, but age is not one of them. You know, regarding the Child's Pugh B, I'd say all the answers are correct because we don't know. You know, everyone will quote a little bit of their favorite subgroup analysis in one study or another or their own experience. But the reality is it doesn't exist. And you know, as Eileen mentioned, and I think the key factor here is to really understand, because Chelsea Pew score is from the 70s, and it assesses primarily liver function in a cirrhotic patient. It wasn't designed to look at a cancer patient. And when patients have a cancer in their liver or and multiple tumors, that can actually affect their liver function. And there are patients who actually will need a response, and that will actually improve their liver function if they have a good response. So that's what atezobev would do. You know, I don't think it's unreasonable to consider sorafenib and lenvatinib, but, you know, for the Chelsea PUB score, 7, say, maybe 8 minus, playing with numbers here, you know, with a great performance status, I'd go with atezobev. Do I have data? No, but I'm just don't have data for anything else. I think this would make the most sense from my standpoint.
So, Kim, a comment/question in the chat room that I've heard a lot. This is from Ibrahim, who says, I have a 70-year-old lady with localized HCC post-successful TACE, but unfortunately, while the local liver disease was controlled, the patient developed distant bone mets. Question about the role of atezo-bev in non-metastatic disease. And, you know, the question of, you know, we had sort of an algorithm in the past where we would use local therapy to the liver sometimes multiple times. Has that approach changed in your interdisciplinary care now that you have, you know, at least one regimen that can cause objective responses? Are you finding people holding off on local procedures like the TACE in that situation, Kim?
Yeah, so I think it's an evolving story, and it's a place where data is not terribly, you know, available. And so I suspect that it's institutional and that we all sort of do what we think is the best for the patient in front of us in these scenarios. I think that at Penn, I would say that we're still using local therapies a lot and sort of delaying the onset of systemic therapies to kind of save them for when we might need them. I mean, it is awfully appealing to taste somebody or you know whatever and then wait and then see what happens and only at progression to engage the systemic therapy. But there certainly are cases where we are engaging the systemic therapy earlier, sometimes to try to get a response that then would lead to an alternative treatment, and in other cases because the atezo-bev is actually quite easy to give. It's not terribly toxic. Patients tolerate it very well. I mean, we're really in a very different era from when we had sorafenib alone, which makes everybody quite miserable and is a challenging drug to use, and the TKI as the TKIs are. So I think it's an evolving story, patient by patient. Would say that we often do start with our local regional therapies still here, but it's changing as we go.
So, Philip, we were going to ask you to talk about one of your Chalk Talk slides, but I actually see some stuff in the chat room I think will be more interesting. So, audience, you can read the Chalk Talk slide later. But Ritiya says, would you consider atezo-bev in a patient with a history of ruptured or, you know, HCC, so a bleed from an HCC? Abdul says, how do you differentiate progressive disease in the liver from immune-mediated hepatitis from an IO?
So basically, in someone who had a history of ruptured HCC, I would be concerned about that because when you have rupture, you have an issue of healing process, which may be complete or incomplete. And giving a drug like bevacizumab, in my judgment, will be risky. That's a patient who I will be very much concerned to do that.
And then the other question about now, I've heard a bunch of cases like this. Is the patient progressing? Or are they getting autoimmune hepatitis from an IO? How do you deal with it? I mean, there's no simple formula, but clinically, Philip, have you seen that? And how do you deal with it?
Well, I was dealing with a different disease today with the increasing liver function test. What I did was I decided to withhold the IO and see if the liver function test will improve. That's probably the simplest way of trying to know in the absence of any other signs or symptoms to suggest disease progression.
So let's go to the number one question that the audience has, which is sequencing beyond first line. They pretty well got the flavor of the first line, at least for now, although I am curious what you all think about the comment there about pembro lenvatinib. We're seeing that pop up everywhere. I'm curious what you think IO-TKI has a history, has a future actually with HCC, but we'll talk about that in a second. Let's get into the issue of second line and beyond after atezo-bev and second line in general. Here's our other faculty colleagues.
I think the data is all over the place. It is very much up to the individual prescriber. Some people I've noticed use cabo. I guess some will reach at that point for ramucirumab. Reach, pardon the pud. Personally, I feel out of all of them, most comfortable with lenvatinib.
The second line space has not been well studied after atezolizumab and bevacizumab therapy. And so, unfortunately, we're kind of in a somewhat data-free zone. I personally like lenvatinib in that setting. I find that therapy better tolerated, at least in the patients that I have given. And I think it's probably at least similar efficacy to the other TKIs.
So, Eileen, first of all, I'd like you to take a look at some of the answers the audience provided in terms of second-line therapy. So we said atezo-bev first-line, 14 months later, we put in AFP elevated just so we could be more inclusive in the options. And the number one answer from the audience is cabo, but then lenvatinib's not far behind, and ramucirumab. When we asked our faculty, it seems pretty split in general between lenvatinib and cabo. We also asked the question, and I'm not sure how many people right now out there starting out on sorafenib, but some were even on it from before. But what about the patient who gets, for whatever reason, first-line sorafenib, and the audience is up for second-line atezo-bev, although I'm not sure we have any data in that, but at least the faculty feels the same way, although a couple of people, Eric Van Cutsem says ramucirumab, and Philip says regorafenib. So, Eileen, how do you think about second-line therapy in the patient that gets atezo-bev and second-line therapy in the patient that gets, let's say, for example, sorafenib?
Yeah, so I think the videos and these points are great. This is a very, it's an area where we don't have clarity, right, in terms of what to do. So for patients who've had atezolizumab and bevacizumab, I think a TKI is you know, typically the next step, and lenvatinib, I think, is a good choice for these patients. And for patients who've had sorafenib, and we're seeing less and less, right, people having sorafenib in North America these days as their first line choice. But there is data for essentially any drug you like in the HCC field in that space, because that's where the trials have been conducted. But we don't have data for people who've had lenvatinib first, or for people who've had atezolizumab and bevacizumab first. So thinking beyond, it's, you know, comes down to TKI versus IO choice, and then the sort of sequencing option. So for me, for somebody who's had atezolizumab, bevacizumab, lenvatinib, next step, and then depending on AFP, maybe ramucirumab as a third line option, revisiting checkpoint combination, I think, is consideration. And then cabozantinib has data in second and third line, so that's also out there in terms of a consideration. Probably less use of regorafenib, even in the days when we didn't have the other choices, that may have been the go-to after sorafenib for people who've done well on that front line.
So, Philip, here's your Chalk Talk slide on second-line therapy. But before you go through that, maybe you can respond. I was mentioning TKI or lenvatinib pembro, and Abdul in the chat room says, how about going to lenvatinib pembro after atezo-bev? Of course, now you're going IO to IO, but... So first of all, any thoughts, Philip, about the future of IO TKI? There's like three approved in renal cell cancer. We talk about this all the time. Endometrial cancer, we talk about it all the time. Any future for that strategy in HCC? And then, Philip, if you can go through your Chalk Talk slide on second-line therapy. But first, what do you think about lenvatinib pembro, Philip?
I certainly think that there is a future for it. But then again, where do you place it in the front line? Because now you're competing with another regimen. So the short answer is I do believe that it's going to be an active combination, which is good. And it's going to be relatively well tolerated, as we see from the PROMI data. When it comes to sequencing, second line and beyond, and as I said before, I believe in exposing the patient to the classes of drugs we have now. So if we're doing atezo-bev in the front line, I don't see a rationale for going into a ramucirumab in the second line or an IO in the second line. So going into TKIs. Now, within the TKI group of drugs, class of drugs, they're not all created the same. They also have different profiles of molecular targets. So for that reason, I think sequencing TKIs is almost like saying you're sequencing different classes of drugs. I certainly wouldn't repeat the same class one after the other, like ramucirumab, as I mentioned to you earlier. At this point in time, most patients are starting off with atezo-bev, so second line, third line is going to be probably a TKI, and then you come back maybe with an IO combination or even ramucirumab. That would be my way of thinking when it comes to this. Certainly, patient preferences and other patient factors will also play a role into this. And again, Tony raised the point about compliance and all that, but those are probably not as a major problem.
So, Kim, again, really good stuff going on in the chat room. I'll ask you a few of those things. Diana mentioned comments, we're talking about TKIO, that the Atezo-Cabo study was not positive. So I guess that's sort of in the other, but lenvatinib-pembro is a different combination. Anyhow, Stephen wants to know, what about ipi-nivo? Everybody brings this up in every tumor. Can you start out with an IO? Can you later on, is there any data to support using anti-CTLA-4 and PD-1? Also, another interesting question from Ahmad, does the etiology of the HCC in any way affect your choice of therapy?
So the question about ipi-nivo, again, we're dealing with almost being victims of our own success here, having so many treatments becoming, you know, it's wonderful. When we all, you know, when I started, we only had sorafenib, and it was kind of, oh, looking at Kim, when it's sorafenib or hospice time. So we're in a much more expansive situation now. But the issue is that, as we've all said, there's no great data on how to sequence these things. I have to actually agree with Philip. I like to expose people to different classes of drugs in the hope that I can somehow exploit biology that I haven't exploited previously. Again, data free, but I think if a person has had atezo-bev and has had just a single IO agent at that point, maybe after TKI, it would not be at all unreasonable to try the combination if you have nothing else that has more data behind it to offer that. So I have done that. I have used a combination PD-1 CTLA-4 to try to reinvigorate a response in somebody who has failed single agent, whether it's nivo alone or atezo-bev. In terms of the etiology of the HCC and my choice of treatment, no, that doesn't actually play a big role in my decision in terms of what to use as a systemic agent. You have to be, of course, careful and mindful of liver function and work closely with your hepatologist to make sure that there isn't an overlapping issue. But I have not used that as a reason or a lack of reason to give a specific treatment just based on that.
So Eileen, I'll show you some of the questions that the audience, more questions the audience asked, but also Padma in the chat room wants to know, what do you do with a patient who starts out with single agent IO that was started before the atezo-bev data, now has progression, Eileen, would you add bev into it or switch to something else? So we can start with that one, Eileen, then we'll show you the audience's questions.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the person and the context of the progression, right? Slow progression may be worthwhile adding an additional agent. If it's really significant progression, I like the idea of changing the class of drugs, as Philip and Kim and Tony brought up. I think that's critical, right? Because there's a certain timeliness too. We don't want to lose a window of opportunity for these patients in terms of having access to all of the active agents that are available in this setting. So I think thinking about the sequence is important, but also just the context of the specific progression for the patient.
So Tony, I'd like to get your take on choice of IO in the second line setting, tolerability issues that come up, and also hear a couple other questions from the audience. So we talked about the first one already. The second one's kind of interesting. Do you ever use 8 milligrams of lenvatinib? The person says they can't really have a hard time getting these patients beyond 8. That's a pretty low dose. This issue comes up all the time. Then endometrial cancers. And someone else wants to know, what about people with prior liver transplant? I think obviously the question here is IO. So Tony, your experience, second line tolerability issues, and these two other questions about lenvatinib dosing and prior transplant and prior autoimmune disease.
Yeah, prior, for second line therapy, for IO overall, so for atezo-bev, the experience is certainly mostly anecdotal. and young. So it's difficult to say, you know, whether atezo-bev is going to behave any differently in the second line post-TKI, which is something that we're probably not going to see much of. You know, the Nivo was withdrawn off the market. We still have pembrolizumab, which may essentially end up with the same fate. So single agent IO may not have that that level of support. Ipi-Nivo is a bit problematic beyond in HCC at least, because the dose that was used in the study was actually the more toxic regimen. Although to be frank with you, I used the lesser toxic regimen in the clinic if I ever do. And so, you know, IO is here to stay, but only as a combo and not a single agent, as it appears. You know, lenvatinib, I keep on hearing everyone talking about how lenvatinib is such an easy drug. It's not. It may be a little bit easier than the more miserable drugs, but it's not necessarily a trip in the park itself. And lower doses end up being the rule rather than the exception for lenvatinib. There's a high risk, about 30 to 40% of rejection of the transplanted liver. And that's certainly a significant issue in a setting that remains palliative at the end of the day. Although you see some remarkable responses, this is not, or any of these are not MSI high like responses. And so frankly, taking a risk, you know, at a patient with transplant is not justifiable. So I would certainly avoid it. Finally, for the autoimmune diseases, depending, we've actually worked very closely with other specialists. So Hashimoto's thyroiditis, rheumatoid arthritis, or what have you. As long as you can work very closely with, you know, with your specialist or endocrinologist or rheumatologist or what have you, and we've done that to monitor the situation, you can certainly take the risk, but it has to be a risk that's well measured. In all frankness, you know, I try to avoid the situation if I have to, but many instances we end up in a situation where we have to use them. And so I've done it. I've worked mostly with Hashimoto's thyroiditis and rheumatoid arthritis, closely with other specialists, and we've been able to navigate through.
So, Philip, I pulled a couple of slides. This is actually what I was talking about. We saw a press release about this COSMIC-312 trial. Any comments about what they're looking at here and what we know about this at this point, Philip?
So this is a combination. And again, I have to make the point that, in my opinion, at the end of the day, we are going to need combinations in this disease. And because we have individual active drugs, the combinations will prevail as we go forward in the coming years. So this is a cabo-atezo combination, which is tested against single agent sorafenib and also single agent cabozantinib. The press release from this study, which was in patients who didn't have any prior treatment and the usual criteria of the Charles-Pugh, showed that the PFS endpoint was met, basically. Hazard ratio of 0.63, but the OS hadn't met at the point of the publishing of the press release, and it was just trending. So we just have to wait and see what's happening with the OS. Well, at least for the PFS, it was positive.
Any comments on the use of cabozantinib? Again, here's a slide that you presented from the Celestial trial, which you went through. But what's your clinical experience with the drug and also your clinical experience with ramucirumab in the second and third line setting, again, in terms of efficacy and tolerability, Philip?
So ramucirumab is, in my experience, is an easier drug to use. It's a monoclonal antibody. And when you're looking at drugs, you're also looking at how they fare in patients who have abnormal liver function tests. So a monoclonal antibody should be fine in someone with liver dysfunction. However, the benefit of ramucirumab is, again, limited, and the slide you showed was against a placebo, so it's not against any other active drug. And so there's a modest benefit of the ramucirumab, and it's in patients who have an AFP of 400 and above, and I don't think anyone has a good explanation what's the link of the AFP to the response to the treatment. Cabozantinib is relatively, again, well-tolerated, although not as easy as ramucirumab. Certainly, there is a bit more of the side effects with it, but certainly it can be well managed in terms of if you can adjust the dose as you go along in terms of patients developing any difficult side effects. And certainly it has shown benefit, and I would say the benefit, in my opinion, I see it more than I think it's for the ramucirumab. And I'm not really surprised, because cabozantinib is a multi-kinase inhibitor. It has more than the VEGF-HFR targeting. So for that reason, I'm not surprised it's a better drug. But at the same time, because of the liver status and liver metabolism, it may be a bit more trickier as we advance in the liver dysfunction.
We're going to go to another TikTok, and then Kim, maybe you can comment on both LAG-3 as well, maybe TIM-3. I heard of that one too. And then, but then this question that we asked the faculty, and now we're talking about pancreatic cancer, and we're talking about neoadjuvant therapy and people who appear to have resectable cancers, and the general issues about neoadjuvant therapy. Here are your colleagues.
We discuss all our patients in our MDT. We have a quite aggressive surgical approach. In the small tumors, clearly resectable, we often still go for surgery followed by FOLFIRINOX. I'm not convinced that we will do that in 3-4 years, but it would not be wrong to start with the chemotherapy in these patients with clearly resectable disease.
I don't feel that in the majority of patients that's the right thing to do, both for clinical reasons or for emotional reasons when we talk to patients. And the surgeons obviously play a role in that decision too. If you have a patient who's resectable and the patient's eager and motivated to get resected, and you don't have absolute data to support that you shouldn't be doing that, it's a hard discussion with the patient.
It used to be that when a patient presented with resectable pancreas cancer, we were doing the upfront resection, you know, right away for these patients. But recently over the last, I'd say, 5 years, have really transitioned to neoadjuvant therapy for all patients.
So there, and I'm calling that a little bit of a controversy, Kim, as opposed to consensus. So first, any comments about LAG-3 or other checkpoints HCC?
LAG-3, I believe there are trials ongoing. So I think that there are trials with LAG-3 and IO combinations in HCC. And so I think that biology we're trying to exploit the specific biology that is being mentioned there. I'm not aware of any published data looking at efficacy of those agents though, but no, Tony's agreeing. Okay, good. In terms of, like, I'm not sure, I don't think so.
But you're correct. I mean, So LAG-3 is supposedly, mechanisms of resistance, and a lot of the work has been actually in prior PD-1 inhibitors and across not just HCC but other cancers, and results in lots of other malignancies has been lukewarm. So we'll see.
We'll see what happens. In terms of I love the pancreas cancer one. That's a great question to sink our teeth into, and certainly controversy among a lot of us. I strongly believe in neoadjuvant treatment, even for resectable patients with pancreatic cancer, for a number of different reasons. One is that once you've operated on somebody, and this is especially true in a Whipple and a little bit less true in a distal pancreatectomy and splenectomy, is that there's a reasonably long recovery period. So 6 to 8 weeks for some patients with a Whipple before they can actually be healed and become, get all fixed up and get ready to start chemotherapy. And in that setting, if you, there's a risk. We think a lot of patients have micrometastatic disease or systemic disease, even when they appear to be resectable. And so cleaning some of that up or treating some of that prior to surgery is probably, in my opinion, the right thing to do for a lot of those patients. Second is that, especially post-Whipple, it is actually harder to treat patients effectively with good, strong chemotherapy post-surgically. They are typically more, their digestive systems work better. We're using FOLFIRINOX. We're going to give them diarrhea. It is typically easier preoperatively. So getting some of that out of the way preoperatively is good. And then the least popular reason, as you can imagine in clinic, is the fact that we want to avoid as many futile surgeries as we possibly can. And it is everybody's worst, situation when a patient recurs at their first follow-up visit restaging for adjuvant therapy and has 3 liver metastases. It's devastating. So in our institution, we are moving more and more towards at least partial neoadjuvant, sometimes total neoadjuvant, sometimes perioperative, but many patients are getting something prior to going to the operating room. Not everybody, but a lot.
So, Tony, you did the chalk talk on this topic. Can you comment?
Yes. No, I totally agree with Kim and I'm sure with the other colleagues. Of course, ultimately, you know, there's a study going through Alliance that's going to help us hopefully answer this a little bit better. But I mean, I totally agree that the default has to be neoadjuvant therapy when there's no clinical trial that's available. So someone is asking, but what is total neoadjuvant? Meaning you give the whole shebang before the surgery, and leave nothing to after surgery, which has been now the standard in lots of the disease settings such as esophagus, cancer of the esophagus minus the PD-1 post, has been true for rectal. We're moving more and more of all this treatment prior to surgery. I mean, there are exceptions right now. I mean, if you have a small tumor, lymph node negative, normal CA19-9, minimal to no symptoms, my surgeon says, I want to take this one to surgery now, you know, I'm not going to argue with that. So I think neoadjuvant is the rule and should be the rule. You know, in terms of how much FOLFIRINOX you would give, but, you know, it's almost impossible to give really the full 12 cycles or 6 months of FOLFIRINOX. To complicate that further, you know, for some patients, not the clearly resectable, but borderline or maybe, you know, somewhat on the unresectable spectrum, you may need some element of radiation. You may end up with 3 to 4 months of FOLFIRINOX. You know, you can consider continuing FOLFIRI. The oxaliplatin is the one that's problematic. But I frankly think 3 to 4 months of FOLFIRINOX may be more than sufficient for most patients. I'll stop here.
So, Eileen, of course, a key issue in terms of neoadjuvant therapy, in addition to this question of resectable patients, is the patient who's borderline resectable. And you put together this chalk talk, and maybe you can comment a little bit about how your interdisciplinary board defines or what kind of cases, what creates a criteria for, quote, borderline resectable, and then how you think through treatment in that situation.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. And just to follow on, you know, what's been echoed already, this is really the key setting for the disease for multidisciplinary discussion. You need oncology, you need the radiation team, and you need the surgical team to have a consensus in terms of the plan. So just in terms of definition, so venous involvement primarily makes it borderline. Arterial involvement, we're getting more into that locally advanced spectrum. So sticking to primarily venous involvement here, by definition, if they're borderline resectable, they can go to the operating room, but there's a high probability that going to have a positive margin resection. So expert consensus guidelines for this group of patients, it's a neoadjuvant approach. And I think the key other issue is, while we think we know how that patient might do in terms of their extent of vascular involvement, we really need to keep an open mind and to bring this back for ongoing multidisciplinary discussion. And I think we've all been surprised in a good direction, but also in a not so good direction for these patients. And I think that's critical to have your surgeon weigh in and provide a perspective as to whether there's a reality that going to the operating room after maximum response has been identified, which is, you know, as I think my colleagues are saying, round about, in my opinion, about 4 months. Mm-hmm. We're sort of seeing limiting toxicity and response plateauing.
So Eileen, Dan in the chat room refers to some data from University of Wisconsin in terms of, you know, Gem NAB versus FOLFIRINOX in the neoadjuvant setting. But how do you make how do you choose which neoadjuvant therapy, Eileen?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. And I would say there's much more equipoise in the last period of time than there used to be before. And this comes from the SWOG perioperative study that Philip and colleagues were involved in. So just a reminder for the audience, this was in resectable pancreas cancer, but two parallel arms, not directly compared, but compared to historical controls of GemNab paclitaxel and modified FOLFIRINOX. And at the end of the day, these look more similar rare than different. And if anything, I think this was to many people's surprise, and certainly mine, that there was an edge perhaps with gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel in favor of pathologic response, and numerically slightly superior in terms of OS. So I think that's really interesting, and it's a little bit discordant from what we have with the adjuvant data, right? So it's hard to put all of this together, but I think bottom line is both in, I think, are reasonable choices. And if I can just make one more point about how we select patients, so I think right now we can't upfront as to who's going to benefit from more from one regimen than the other, but there are some data based on, you know, RNA-seq and subtyping of pancreas cancer that suggests that patients who have this classical type may benefit from FOLFIRINOX, and patients who have this basal type less likely to benefit from FOLFIRINOX. So I think we're hoping we'll be there soon. We're not there yet, but that's you know, that's an area where there's a lot of interest in terms of profiling and trying to get biomarkers to predict.
Now I'm a little bit more excited. I like biomarkers. So Philip, any comments about particularly this issue of the subtype or biomarkers in both adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting, and how you go about, I mean, in the past, I just always hear clinical things, the patient's too old, what they can tolerate. I like the idea of trying to use biology. Philip, any thoughts about both choice of neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy?
Unfortunately, the only thing we have at this point in time is focusing on DNA repair pathways, because we have drugs that damage the DNA, and if we have a faulty DNA repair, then that makes sense. And here we're talking about like BRCA mutations, like PALB mutations, and also in other, if we extend it into other aspects of DNA repair, HRD. However, in real life, we're not really applying it except for the BRCA1 and 2 and the PALB2. We don't have really enough evidence to include the other biomarkers in the mix. And this is as far as I can tell you about the biomarkers when it comes to using them in this disease. Eileen mentioned to you the classical versus basal. That is something which you cannot get an answer like quickly. I mean, it may be. There's also some evidence that in colon cancer, there is a biomarker that can predict for response to FOLFOX. You may want to use that biomarker, but again, I don't do it because that is going to be tested now in a more prospective manner. So at this point in time, when it comes to biomarkers, unless my colleagues have something else, it's really the DNA repair and more focused on the BRCA. But I wouldn't be using, obviously, PARP inhibitors in this setting. I'm relying on platinum agents.
And PARP inhibitors is the number one question that people have, but let's deal with a couple other things first. Kim, I'd like you to respond to these thoughts from Dr. Deming about adjuvant therapy, first-line therapy. And in the past, we spent a lot of time talking about it, but tonight we're focusing more on new approaches, but here's some thoughts from Dr. Deming.
It just comes down to tolerability. Now, we can get some older folks, especially those who are very fit and who haven't just had an operation, through a modified FOLFIRINOX, but it's really tough for a 78-year-old to do modified FOLFIRINOX after a Whipple. And to be honest, with the gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, it tends to be a dose-reduced version of that. When I meet a patient with metastatic pancreas cancer, I sit down and I talk through all the different options and the potential benefit and the toxicities for that. And so it ends up being a very kind of patient-specific discussion. What are their goals of care, and you know, how aggressive do they want to be? Unfortunately, we're not seeing huge differences in outcomes for patients, whether they're doing a modified FOLFIRINOX versus a gem-nab-paclitaxel.
So, Kim, again, sort of the art of oncology, the way you approach a choice of adjuvant therapy, particularly in older patients, and also how you approach a first-line therapy metastatic disease, again, of course, particularly in older patients. Any thoughts, Kim?
Yeah, absolutely. So for adjuvant treatment, I actually think there's now a little bit more equipoise in terms of, at least I feel a little bit more comfortable in a patient who is not well enough to get modified FOLFIRINOX, which is what I would choose if a patient was fit and well. That's the best data we have for the best outcomes. If a patient is not able to do that, like Dusty said, whether it's due to age or other comorbidities, I actually feel that the updated APAC data gives me a little bit more leverage to say that it's okay to use gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. As we've seen, the updated survival data did show a significant improvement in survival. And actually, the, you know, the other piece of, even though it wasn't the primary endpoint, the other secondary endpoint, the investigator evaluations of recurrence, which take into context tumor markers and patient symptoms, was also showed a significance even with PFS, even though the primary endpoint was central review. And we do need to remember that that was the primary endpoint for that trial. So for a patient who's older and who probably can't tolerate, I do actually reach for gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. My personal experience with gemcitabine and capecitabine, which was the XBAC4 trial, is actually that it is also very difficult to tolerate. I don't know what it is about that combination of gem with cape, but I have had a very hard time getting patients through that without substantial dose reductions, and I don't reach for it very often. And then for somebody who's really frail, there is always the fallback of single agent gemcitabine from the olden days. In terms of first line metastatic disease, Dusty, I think I agree a lot with what he said in terms of tolerability and patient goals. I think there's a definite role, as Philip said, for if you know or strongly suspect that a patient has a BRCA or PALB2 variant or some other homologous recombination deficiency, that you'd want to reach for a platinum first, potentially, if you know that data. Sometimes hard to get in the first line setting, but as one of Eileen's beautiful study showed, cisplatin and gemcitabine has approximately a 65 to 70% response rate in that group. So that's a group where you want to reach for platinum for sure. And there is a ongoing trial called Precision Promise, which is run by PanCAN, which will directly compare for the first time those two combinations of FOLFIRINOX and gem nab-paclitaxel in the first line setting. So we will get some data at some point soon.
Well, let's see what the audience thinks, but also Eileen, there's a comment in the chat room from Dan, who apparently was very impressed with your presentation at ESMO GI, which I didn't know about the future of pancreatic cancer and, quote, a new KRAS world full of fusions. So I want to hear about that. We had a bunch of questions about KRAS. Also, he was impressed by your discussion, the landscape of new drugs, quote, amazing. So I'm ready to get excited. But first, Eileen, you put together a chalk talk about some more conventional today questions. We asked the audience, we talked about first-line therapy metastatic disease in a 75-year-old. You can see there's a consensus in the audience. Just kidding. It's completely split between modified FOLFIRINOX and GEM-NAB. I would say that the faculty is a little bit split as well in terms of those two choices. I guess it gives you an idea that it's maybe somewhat of a toss-up. We also asked about third-line therapy, FOLFIRINOX, GEM-NAB, a common first and second line therapy. People seem generally on board with NALIRI-5FU. The faculty a little bit more varied in their answers. So Eileen, you put together this chalk talk slide sort of summarizing your thoughts about how you think through patients who had prior systemic therapy, second line and beyond.
Thanks, Neil, and thanks, Dan, for your compliment. So looking at how to address frontline therapy for a patient with newly diagnosed metastatic pancreas cancer, I think it's all in terms of the goals of therapy and patient preference and taking into account not so much age, but functional status and comorbidities. I think they're the critical issues. And these days, it's all about, is there any opportunity for refining treatment in terms of genomics? And just to plug once more, that we undergo or recommend a germline and, where feasible, somatic tumor sequencing for these patients, not so much that it's going to impact the initial choice, but to open any doors for that subset of patients going forward. And considerations of ports and fusional therapy and alopecia also factor into the choice of frontline treatment. And like in the earlier disease space, I think both options are reasonable. And as we've learned from our colleagues in the colorectal world, it may not be so much which is first, but more getting access to all of the components that contribute to survival is most critical in terms of augmenting long-term outcome. And if I can also make one also important point of the supportive care aspects of this, nutrition, pancreatic enzymes, managing pain, treating thrombosis, they also, along with addressing biliary obstruction, impact the outcomes in this disease, so the supportive care.
So Eileen, I'm ready to get real excited. Can you give us a little synopsis? Of course, we have sotorasib approved in lung cancer for KRAS 12C, but lots of other cancers, including pancreatic, have all various versions of KRAS. What's going on in terms of targeting that? And are the other sort of novel approaches, Eileen, that you're excited about?
Thank you. Yes. So I think just splitting pancreas cancer into RAS wild type and KRAS. So about 92% of people with pancreas cancer plus minus will have a KRAS mutation. However, if one takes patients under the age of 50, we are more likely to find, maybe twice as likely to find, a KRAS wild type tumor. And that's important because there are other actionable drivers beyond KRAS. And that's where the fusions come in. So rare things like NTRK infusions, etc., and NRG1 fusions. And we saw some exciting data at ASCO looking at zenocutuzumab, which is a HER2, HER3 targeting agent, which has shown impressive single agent activity and quite durable for patients who've had previous treatments for their pancreas cancer in the setting of KRAS wild type and this targetable fusion. However, the challenge is, and the problem is, it's 1% of pancreas cancer or less in terms of that context. But we also see slightly more MSI high in this setting, ERBB2, the occasional BRAF fusion. So if you see RAS wild type, first of all, if there are other you know, P53 or CDKN2, it's probably real. And then you need to think about doing additional sequencing to look for these fusions. If you don't see any other somatic mutations, then it's a question of adequacy of the tissue or the quality control in terms of the DNA. And it probably is not a true KRAS wild type. So putting that aside, going to KRAS itself, and I think we're beginning now to really get excited around KRAS in pancreas cancer as there are drugs that are coming to the clinic. So the just following on the story in lung and to a lesser extent in colorectal cancer, 12C subset, about 1%, there's some activity there. D and V inhibitors are hopefully going to be in the clinic late this year, early next. There are some approaches targeting endoscopic using an siRNA against KRAS, and the whole autophagy story may also metabolism indirectly targeting RAS. So it's kind of a lot of really interesting areas early in terms of development, but I think stay tuned in this space.
So Tony, we're going to go back to our other faculty members and get into the issue of PARP inhibitors and targeting that in pancreatic cancer. And the first question being, what kind of workup is appropriate nowadays in terms of germline and or somatic testing in patients with pancreatic cancer, particularly patients who have no family history whatsoever? Here are some comments from your colleagues.
Every patient gets germline testing, regardless of whether they have family history. I've seen a number of patients who get some interesting germline mutation picked up, BRCA being the majority, even in the absence of a family history, and it's paid for and it's approved and it's on the NCCN guidelines. So I do encourage it in any and all patients, and I don't see a downside. Mutational testing is quite a bit different. I don't necessarily re-biopsy a patient for the purposes of doing NGS testing. If there's tissue and I can get it done, I do it, you know, on occasion. I have used it. I mean, a patient with PALB2 mutation who's been on olaparib for a while. I have a patient with an ATM mutation and germline ATM where I've used it.
Would you use it in a patient who on an NGS assay had a high HRD?
I probably would, but, you know, a little more reluctantly. I don't think there's a lot of data for that. And I would probably sooner use chemotherapy in that context and then maybe rely on it, you know, in a third line scenario, to be candid.
We have a trial ongoing right now where we look at the activity of olaparib patients with somatic BRCA mutations, but also somatic HRD, such as ATM, ATR, PALB2, CHEK2 mutations. I don't have data. We cannot recommend it.
So, Tony, I'm curious, first of all, how you, for practical purposes, what do you do in terms of testing? Are you testing everybody? Do you test patients who have localized disease, for example? And, you know, putting aside trial issues, you know, let's just talk about practical patient care. And again, before we get into whether to use a PARP inhibitor and how to use it, what are some of the scenarios where you would even think about it? Obviously, BRCA germline, but what about somatic mutations, BRCA somatic, HRD we talked about now, and ovarian cancer, they look at that routinely, PALB2, other mutations. So, Tony, any thoughts about what kind of testing you do and what kind of alterations make you at least think about a PARP inhibitor?
Yes. So, first of all, I agree, germline testing for everyone, that's undeniable. I actually do think that every patient has the right to have NGS testing. And with pancreas, as Eileen mentioned, you know, there are a lot of emerging targets. Now, I would argue that even in the absence of a germline BRCA or PALB, there is, which is about 2 to 3% of the overall population. If you're in Manhattan, it's probably higher than that. but the reality is across the country, it's 2 to 3%. But there is another 2 to 3% that would have somatic. And somatic alterations appear to predict in a very similar way versus germline alterations for BRCA for responses. I mean, we've seen that with rucaparib. They have been tested with olaparib or talazoparib or others, but I mean, there's no reason to think that there's any differences. So you do see those responses. You don't want to miss those because they're actually platinum sensitive, exquisitely sensitive. You can get complete responders and significant prolongation of survival. So I think that, you know, every attempt should be made. And frankly, most of these patients will present with liver metastatic disease. And these are actually tumors that are accessible, and we should do everything possible to get them. You know, one would argue that you could certainly consider liquid biopsies for some of these patients, and we've actually published data that you could depict some of these alterations. But, you know, this cancer sheds much less than, say, colon or gastric or other cancers, much less circulating tumor DNA. And so it's a little bit more difficult to actually find positive circulating. If you find them, great. But if you don't, I would still try to biopsy and run an NGS. And regardless whether you have trials or not, and the fact that we have a lot more trials trying to be very targeted makes the case for even further to do that. Then, you know, Eileen mentioned NTRK fusions, which are present in less than 1% of patients. Now, that may sound like a very small number, but again, those patients have a significant response. And if you don't look in every single patient, guess what? You're going to miss them. And most liquid biopsy platforms will miss quite a sizable number of those patients. So that's, you know, that's probably a long response for that. But NGS for everyone, germline for everyone, no doubt. Liquid if it's an impossible task. Now, regarding, you know, where to use PARP inhibitors, you know, as you know, that's a bit controversial, and we may not all agree on this, but, you know, my stance remains the same. You know, the POLO trial is great. It taught us that we can certainly make a difference. The reality is it didn't change survival outcome and certainly pushed the PFS, but what it told us is that essentially, you know, a PARP inhibitor in a platinum-sensitive patient population could be an option for patients. But that requires quite a discussion. I mean, there are toxicities to single-agent PARP. Question is, you know, if you have a patient who went on a platinum and had a complete response, and I've had a few of those, do you really need to expose them to any therapy? I've had patients who went for a year or two without the need for any therapy. Again, we you know, one can argue back and forth about these. The reality, the gold standard has not been moved with a PARP inhibitor. The exciting news is, and I know both Eileen and Kim and you know have been leading a lot of these efforts, is where do you move these agents into earlier stages? How do you compound on them with PD-1 inhibitor plus PARP? which is more exciting than single agent PARP. Are we going to move the needle even further now in the early stage and the later stage? You know, both Kim and Eileen have spearheaded, you know, and continue to spearhead efforts there. You know, we've been working on trying to combine PARP plus chemo, primarily with nanoliposomal irinotecan. We finished the first phase one component of a study and expanding into essentially taking advantage of the pharmacokinetic particularities of nanoliposomal irinotecan and how to combine it sequentially with PARP inhibitors. And it kind of makes sense because they hit a little bit differently aspects of DNA damage repair. And so there may be some synergism. I mean, at least preclinically, we know that there is, but we want to show that in the clinic as well. So PARP inhibitors actually continue to be a very exciting aspect of development in pancreas cancer, primarily in the BRCA and PALB. The question that arises is, what do you do with the HRD group? Now that's, you know, expanding beyond just BRCA and PALB. That is a little bit more challenging, and we continue to look at some elements of activity in these subgroups of patients. I think that's going to be a little bit more of a pull, although everything points out to the fact that in the HRD group, platinums tend to do better versus non-platinum agents. So there is credence in pancreas cancer for that HRD group. And perhaps, you know, ultimately PARP inhibitors will show that. Right now, I would not do it off a trial, but I would consider a platinum given some of the data that's published in the HRD group.
So, Philip, some great questions coming in the chat room. Jeffrey wants to know, do you ever see POLE mutations in pancreatic? And you may want to chat a little bit about that. But Demetrius has a really interesting question also. We were talking about neoadjuvant therapy before, and he wants to know, for example, if you have a patient with a BRCA germline, is it approach, if you know that in the neoadjuvant setting, would it change how you approach it? Kim responded in the chat room about the possibility, maybe think more about platinum. But also, and maybe Demetrius saw this in one of our breast program at ASCO, there was a paper presented, only 100 patients, but neoadjuvant PARP in BRCA mm-hmm. patients. Mm-hmm. And they had a 50% path CR rate, which was kind of shocking to me, particularly in view of what you see in breast cancer in the metastatic setting. So, Philip, any information about POLE mutations, and does BRCA status affect neoadjuvant therapy?
So I have seen only one patient with POLE who had multiple mutated genes. And that patient, my experience with that patient was someone who had their locally advanced unresectable disease, but she responded very well to gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, and she ended up having a resection, and she's still alive in 6 years. One case.
There you go. Proves your point.
one case. But back to the, in my opinion, the strength of the BRCA102 as a biomarker is really in predicting response to platinum compounds. It's a strong one, and as Eileen has demonstrated in her study. So sure, yes, if I see someone who has BRCA1 or 2 or PALB2, I discover they have that, then I will switch my treatment to platinum compounds in the neoadjuvant setting or even in the adjuvant setting. Keep in mind, I personally, in any newly diagnosed patient, I do the blood testing for genetic profiling for the germline mutation. So I really get a result within a 10 days or 2 weeks from seeing a patient. So in my case, I get the result even before I start the chemo, almost before I start the chemotherapy. But if I see someone with BRCA1 or 2 or PALB2, for sure, I will be going for a platinum-based treatment. I may extend that to ATM. The question becomes, which platinum? Is it going to be FOLFIRINOX, oxaloplatin, or do I think that cisplatin is a better drug-informing lethal adduct? And that's something which I like to see others' opinions, but I personally am not against converting my practice to a simple gemcitabine cisplatin, which I think in a patient with BRCA1 or 2 mutation may be as effective, if not more, but with less toxicity. So you end up, especially with older patients, with a better therapeutic index.
I'd go for the O'Reilly regime for gem cis.
The gem, I mean, The response state was really shocking. We'll ask Eileen to comment on there. I think it was in the range of 70%, really amazing. Absolutely. But let's go back to our other faculty in terms of where PARP inhibitors fit in. And then we're going to ask Kim to go through her chalk talk on this issue. And Kim gave a fantastic presentation reviewing all the data in depth. But Kim, here's what some of your colleagues think in terms of what they're doing nowadays in terms of integrating PARP into the management of pancreatic cancer.
I do integrate a PARP inhibitor in the majority of patients after a run-up of chemotherapy. I usually prefer GemCis in these patients. I find it well tolerated. And then I kind of follow the POLO trial in the sense that I do want to get some reduction in tumor volume before initiating PARP inhibitors.
When I see a patient with a BRCA mutation, I'm still using FOLFIRINOX in the first line setting. Now, will I consider using a PARP inhibitor as kind of maintenance therapy? I think it depends on how the patient's doing on the FOLFIRINOX. These patients can do quite well with continuing the chemotherapy. And so I don't rush into the use of PARP inhibitors for BRCA mutant pancreas cancer.
PARP inhibitors, we use them today outside of trials for patients in the maintenance, patients responding to a chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy.
I was thinking about, you know, the Olympia trial presented in breast. Is that a strategy, again, that
Yeah, that's a strategy that is extremely relevant, and that's one of the avenues that we will have to look into in trials. We don't have enough data right now to recommend that outside of trials, so I would not recommend it today.
So, Kim, you went through some of the trials looking at that exciting question. I am curious, incidentally, if you think it, if you could access it, would you use a PARP inhibitor in the adjuvant or post-neoadjuvant setting in pancreatic cancer outside a trial? So your thoughts about that, Kim, and in general, maybe you can go through your thoughts about how you approach this question about PARP inhibitors in pancreatic.
So the first question is the testing, and I think my colleagues have very adequately addressed that. I have the Tony Saab approach, which is that everybody gets germline testing, and anybody with advanced disease gets somatic testing as well if there's insufficient tissue. You can do a liquid, but I really prefer a tissue, as Tony said, those assays are much more complete, include DNA and RNA, some of them IHC as well. So in terms of germline testing, perform it right away. Again, you know, you have a metastatic patient in front of you, and if you would like to use the Eileen special, then you need to know that they have a BRCA or PALB variant. And I love to use CisGem, actually. I find it, you know, you have a patient who's not fit enough for FOLFIRINOX. I agree with what the others have said. It is extremely well tolerated, I think, compared to FOLFIRINOX, and I do like to use that. So in terms of chemotherapy, every patient with BRCA or PALB should get a platinum treatment if you're aware of that alteration. It's a little more gray in other, as we've been alluding to, other quote-unquote HRDs. I'm actually very skeptical of CHECK2 and ATM in terms of their true HRD-ness. Talia Golan recently published a paper showing that, in fact, those patients do not have an HRD-high tumor if analyzed by HR-detect. And I haven't seen really, honestly, much impressive activity with PARP in the ATM population for sure. So anyway, if you have somebody with BRCA or PALB2, CisGem and FOLFIRINOX, I think, should be the first things to reach for. Those are the things where there is good data. And if your patient can tolerate one or the other, those are the prospective ones that I would reach for. If you have comorbidities that prevent you or the patient doesn't want to use either of those options, right? So the patient has bad hearing loss, bad renal dysfunction, not great performance status, or some other reason, I actually don't think it's, I still would prefer a platinum than to going to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel in that setting. And I have reached for FOLFOX, and I have reached for GemOx. Philip's point about DNA adducts in cisplatin versus oxaliplatin is a very good one. The Lepard lab published a paper a number of years ago showing that cis works the way we think it should work, whereas oxaliplatin actually has a different mechanism of action. That said, a different primary mechanism. That said, we dose oxaliplatin quite a bit higher than we dose our cisplatin, and there's and in retrospective data, we do see substantial activity and responses in OXAP patients treated with FOLFOX and FOLFIRINOX as well. So maintenance PARP, what do you do with the maintenance PARP? So I like Dusty's answer. I think you talk to the patient about what to do. I think if a patient is thriving and doing great on cisgem, and it's been 4 months and 5 months and 6 months, and they are happy and are really scared to switch off their chemo, then you can keep going. If a patient is having toxicity or would like a break, I think olaparib provides a wonderful opportunity for that. The key you want to make sure is you don't want to wait till they progress on the platinum. That is the key point. Once they start to tip over and are progressing on the platinum therapy, you're much less likely to get activity with the PARP. The rucaparib data suggests that you might not need to wait a full 4 months. So if you have a patient with excessive toxicity or even a patient who wouldn't tolerate chemo, I've actually reached for PARP in that setting as well and haven't looked back. But ideally, you would like to, we also showed, people have also shown in other tumor types that the lowest disease burden might be the best spot to be in. So if you can push them to that state, then that's probably the better strategy. So that is how I have used PARP. The one other key point is that Eric Van Cutsem talked about was the Olympia trial versus that same scenario in pancreatic cancer. So Olympia took high risk patients with BRCA related breast cancer post all curative intent treatment and randomized them to receive olaparib for a year or placebo, was positive, was plenary at ASCO, reduced disease free, improved disease free survival. And we are running a trial in pancreas cancer that Eileen and I indeed are working on together. That is going to be international. And so I would highly recommend that a patient like that would go on that trial. I have not done, although I don't know what I would do if a patient couldn't go on trial for, you know, a eligibility reason or an access reason and had BRCA and platinum therapy. I have not yet reached for a PARP off label in that setting, but curious to see what Eileen thinks. I would put that patient on the trial because we don't have the data yet and we need, and PARP is not risk-free. So we need to know what that data looks like and whether that really benefits our patients.
I'm going to go to Eileen, though, because you've been mentioned about five times here, Eileen. A couple questions. Maybe you can comment a little bit about the findings with the GEM-CIS and the veliparib study. I think it really, really had a big impact on people. Also, Eileen, if you could comment on choice of PARP inhibitor, you know, kind of beyond sort of the FDA constraints and sort of the theoretical, you know, choice, so to speak, in terms of risk and benefit. And also, I'd like you to comment also on the high rate of BRCAness at Memorial, presumably reflection of New York, or I'm not sure exactly why. But if you can comment on those three disparate topics, choice of PARP inhibitor, GEM-CIS, and also why you see so much BRCA in New York.
Right. All right. Well, thank you. Hopefully I'll get all that straight. So maybe starting with GEM-CIS. So this was a very simple concept, and the hypothesis behind this trial was, does adding a PARP inhibitor and a platinum augment response, and does it delay resistance? Because resistance is the huge issue, and resistance to PARP inhibitors are much more common problem in pancreas, occurs early and occurs often relative to breast and ovary cancer. So the what we saw was response rate actually was a little bit higher with the combination, but the overlapping toxicity of myelosuppression was limiting in terms of anemia and in terms of thrombocytopenia in particular. And hence the winner, even though this wasn't designed to directly compare the arms, but the winner was gemcitabine and plain old cisplatin in terms of, you know, 65% response rate in BRCA and PALB2 selected population. And I think Kim and Tony and I think Philip also commented on this, summed it up nicely. They're all, the platinums are active, and it's really hard to say when you come down to it that one is better than the other. But I think the key message is platinum for this patient population. And platinum is clearly more active than a PARP inhibitor, I think. So second question is, which is the best PARP inhibitor? And we don't have any comparative data here. And we have more limited data in pancreas than we do in other diseases. We have olaparib for sure. And Kim's work with, and Tony's work with rucaparib and others. And the, you know, the, I think the most recent data extends the value of PARP inhibitors to somatic BRCA with the rucaparib data and PALB2. Not that we didn't really believe that was true, but we now have data to actually support and use this, and hopefully we'll see an NCCN and future other guideline endorsements just expanding that small but real patient population. And then the question of the patient population we see in New York. So you're right, it is, you know, it is an enriched population of Eastern European, Ashkenazi population and many sort of referred because of the interest in BRCA and all that's going on. So yes, we probably do see a higher, and we do do see a higher percentage compared to others. But at the same time, it's just, you know, to go back to the issue of testing and agnostic testing, if we look at age, if we look at ethnicity, if we look at family history, personal history, taking all of those enrichment factors, when you take those out of the equation, there's still 30 to 40% of people that will have a positive germline mutation that's actionable for them and important for their family that we won't identify if we stick with the more traditional criteria. So that's just the reason why agnostic testing.
So in terms of testing, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about what I call the new non-small cell lung cancer, which is cholangiocarcinoma. And we're going to have like a few comments, and Tony put together a couple of Chalk Talk slides related to that. But first, Philip, I'd like you to respond to the thoughts of your colleagues in terms of, you know, some general issues about cholangiocarcinoma, particularly the issue of genomic testing. Here's your colleagues.
If you're going to think about one GI tumor, which every patient should be NGS, I would say it's cholangio. I think there's enough target potentials of getting drugs either on study or off study that it's worth it. And that makes it quite distinct from pancreas cancer, of course. And because they simply don't have, you know, huge abundance of tissue always, I try to get it up front if I can get it in every patient. I'm hopeful that eventually one of these first line studies gets completed with any of these TKIs and we can replace chemotherapy. We've got a long way to go though. I think a more likely scenario, Neil, is that we'll get hopefully additional chemotherapeutics approved in this disease.
And Philip, I think he was referring to the SWOG. There's a SWOG phase 3 trial looking at upfront chemo. I think it's GemCis versus GemCis plus NAB that is... So any thoughts about that, Philip? And also this issue of testing and cholangio, do you test everybody or do you test them up front? Is there any role for liquid biopsy?
So the SWOG trial completed accrual and it was faster than we ever anticipated. We're expecting results next year. And that was the triplet versus the doublet, as you mentioned. And surprisingly, the triplet wasn't badly tolerated as some people would have expected. So it's a good trial. So we're hopeful that it's going to be positive. Now back to NGS. Yeah, of course. I mean, I will be testing every single patient. In my practice, I do that as part of my initial workup of the patient. It's even built into the staging, if you would, because we would definitely, all of us agree that the molecular makeup is part of the evaluation of the patient that would be done up front. Now, it's not easy. Sometimes you don't have enough tissue. And this is one of the situations where even if you need to do another biopsy, you're justified. Now, do you have to wait until they fail frontline? I personally, as I said, I'd like to do things up front. I have to do it as part of my initial evaluation of the patient because up to 50% of the patients can have actionable mutations. Now, you can always do liquid biopsy. It was mentioned by Tony Saab. I do not know if the liquid biopsy, again, having a similar problem with the pancreas, they may not shed enough to get enough reading in the peripheral blood. But certainly every patient, and it's a situation where a second biopsy is justified if the first biopsy is not really helping you. And then obviously the middle solution is to do a liquid biopsy. And you do it up front. I don't want to wait until the patient is progressing. Because it gives you more ability to talk to the patient in a more longitudinal manner, in a planned way, and patients like that. Yeah.
So Kim, Diana in the chat room is asking about IDH inhibitors, IDH mutations in Calangio, and also the issue I've been hearing more and more about, like this sort of combined entity that's sort of Calangio and HCC histologically. I don't know if there are two tumors or some one weird tumor that has these combinations. So any comments on IDH inhibitors in Calangio, Kim, and this sort of HCC Calangio mix?
So I've actually only treated one patient with an IDH inhibitor who had had that variant, and they it was I don't have a very much experience with that class of drugs myself. I've only treated that one patient. It was based on trial, and it was not well tolerated. It was a tough drug to give. I think it's based on trial data can be certainly should be considered, but I don't know how tolerable it is, and maybe others have more experience with it than I do. In terms of the HCC and cholangio mixed tumors, you know, in the olden days, we typically, so if a scan had an HCC, if a patient's tumor had features consistent with HCC and they had an elevated AFP and they had an underlying liver cirrhosis, we called it a day and we did not require a biopsy. I actually think that the more we do biopsy, which we're doing more and more nowadays, the more we discover these mixed tumors that we otherwise would have missed. I saw one actually this week that is a mixed tumor, but with an AFP of 140,000. So you can be fooled into thinking it's a pure tumor if you do not stick a needle in there. The reason we didn't biopsy is that theoretical risk of seeding. Obviously, in a metastatic patient, that's not as much of an issue, and I'm not sure that that's ever borne out. That's really, really, really a substantial risk. In terms of those tumors, we often go with, we don't know what to do. There is no data to tell us which regimen we should use. So in my experience, I go with what I think is the dominant tumor most likely to cause the life-limiting illness in the patient. What is the most active disease that's going to hurt them the fastest. And there is some data for chemotherapy in HCC. FOLFOX has a small benefit, CISGEM as well. So if you do want to, you know, if you're treating the cholangio component primarily, there's potential that you are also somewhat maybe have a little bit control over the HCC component. But there is, it's a totally data-free zone. We don't know what to do with those patients. So we do our best.
It's interesting you said that your patient didn't tolerate the IDH inhibitor. So the other question, of course, is the issue of FGFR2 translocations. Tony's going to go through that in a second. He made a chalk talk about that. I want to hear about your experiences with these agents. But here's your colleagues talking about it.
At the University of Wisconsin, we actually have a very large cholangiocarcinoma population. We don't know exactly why that population is so large here, but we tend to be one of the national leading accruers for all cholangiocarcinoma studies. One of the most exciting alterations are the FGFR2 translocations. And because of the potential benefit for patients with new targeted therapies, we are sequencing all of our patients with cholangiocarcinoma on diagnosis. Hyperphosphatemia is seen in every patient. One of the rather unknowns that we have in this field is how controlled does the phosphate really need to be? In a patient whose phosphate level gets high, they're almost always asymptomatic from it. We try to, you know, really control it with diet, phosphate binders, and those kinds of things. But I also do try to really push it because I do think dose matters for these agents.
We can use pemigatinib in pretreated patients, FGFR fusion patients. If you look at the data, they are quite robust. This has been approved by EMA also in second line. The big question is, should we do that in first line outside of clinical trials?
So, Tony, I want you to share your experiences with patients like this, but first check out what the audience says. So we said you've got a patient with FGFR2 fusion. What kind of targeted therapy or second-line therapy would they use after first-line chemo? Not too surprising that pemigatinib was first, but I was pretty surprised when people say erdafitinib, which is from bladder cancer, but of course, very similar. The side effects are very similar. Futibatinib, which is not approved yet, and then infigratinib down there lower, interestingly. But when we asked the faculty, in general, people are saying pemigatinib. Interesting, Dusty says either or futibatinib, which is not approved. We also asked the audience, would you consider using targeted therapy, targeting FGFR2 as first-line treatment in a patient who didn't want to get chemotherapy? And the audience says they haven't done it, but they might or would in the right situation. We asked the faculty and a bunch of people, several people have actually already done it, including Eileen. So Tony, here's your chalk talk about FGFR2 inhibitors. Curious, so what we know about these, of course you go through this in your talk in great detail, really recommend people to check it out. But what's sort of the bottom line in terms of where we are today and maybe where we're heading? We have futibatinib, it's on accelerated but not approved yet. I'm curious what you think about that future there. Tony, what are your thoughts?
So we, in a very small area, we have two and a third, as you said, potentially approved. So pemigatinib and infigratinib are the only ones that are approved by the FDA. They appear, at least, you know, from the respective phase two studies, to be similar in terms of their efficacy, although the toxicities seem to be maybe a slightly worse with the infigratinib. And I suspect, again, part of it has to do with a dose that hasn't been figured out as well. Futibatinib appears, at least historically, to be in line with pemigatinib and infigratinib. It's a little bit different. It's irreversible. And at least, you know, in some smaller studies, or I'd say, you know, maybe case series more than studies, there is activity when you fail the infigratinib. And then maybe just of its mechanism of action. So it's interesting to see actually one FGFR inhibitor working when others may not. So that may add another layer for us. The others, you know, are under study, but I'm not sure what their future is in cholangiocarcinoma. I'm intrigued like you, you know, with erdafatinib being put out there, but I suspect because people have familiarity with it in bladder cancer. So overall, you know, I'd say pemigatinib, infigratinib would be, my choice would be for pemigatinib, nothing more than the fact that it was approved first and we have more experience with it.
I put out there that it's not too easy to keep up with things nowadays as a general medical oncologist. We do it, believe it, listen, there are five lines of therapy approved in bladder now. Five lines of therapy that we talked about.
That's going to be cholangio.
Yeah, there you go. So in any event, a real challenge if you're a general medical oncologist trying to keep up with all the newly approved drugs, I think, as we see over and over. I'm curious, Eileen, about your experience with these agents. And one of the things that intrigues me is the elevated phosphate levels, how you deal with that. Do you use diet? Do you use binders? You know, do these patients get symptoms? Any thoughts, Eileen?
Yeah, so I think the two common things are the biochemical ones in terms of the phosphate and then the dermatologic and skin toxicities that we see in the nail toxicities from this class of drugs. So the wisdom is that we do recommend a low phosphate diet. I personally am unconvinced that diet has a major role here. I think when the phosphate is up, we need to go to medications to control that. And it's, you know, unclear what the consequences of not doing that are. Just the development of this class of drugs have, you know, advocated for that approach. I think the skin part and the nails can be uncomfortable. I've had a couple of patients who actually lose their nails, which can be a little bit miserable for them, of course. And I wish we had a way to prevent that sort of toxicity. And for a few people, I've ended up having to stop this class of drugs because of the cutaneous toxicity. So for most people, though, I think they tolerate these agents well. And there's at least three randomized studies with various different FGFR inhibitors in the fusion context comparing directly to cisplatin gemcitabine. So we'll see how that pans out and whether this will become a frontline alternative to conventional chemotherapy for the fusion population.
Or combination with chemo, Eileen?
Perhaps, yeah. I think also phase 1B studies underway addressing that. There's some question that there may be a little bit of antagonism in terms of mechanism for the combination. That's not been validated, but that's been put forward. So I personally would like to see what the combination data looks like and to understand whether it's going to be best together or more likely as a sequential approach.
So final comment from Philip, you know, it's really tough when you, particularly for general oncologists, we're seeing, you know, so many new agents nowadays. If we look at some of the slides that Tony has in his talk, the waterfall plots on these agents look pretty impressive. I don't know that you can sort of separate them out. but they look like impressive. But then it's hard to get a feel for how does that really play out in practice in terms of, you know, responses. It was like osimertinib and lung cancer, where, you know, really has a demonstrable effect. Other targeted therapies, maybe not as effective. Philip, what's your take on how effective these agents are sort of clinically, and where do you see them heading?
Certainly, as you agree, as you will agree with me, one of the important things about their effectiveness is measured by the duration of response. And it comes down to the fact that although majority of the patients may not see a good objective response, but the ones who do get an objective response, it's fairly durable. And we're talking about usually more than 6 months on average that the patient's disease is controlled. And that's really what attracts me about these agents, is that they're not just transient benefit. And then you come to the fact that the longer they are on it, you start to think of the side effects. But certainly, if you really are very close in terms of monitoring the patient and the dose adjustments, I don't see those drugs to be that difficult to use, because if you look at the permanent discontinuation rate in the different trials, these are less than 10% of the patients. So overall, they can be on these drugs longer. But certainly, we haven't seen any such benefit from drugs in the second line in cholangiocarcinoma. I haven't seen any. And the current combinations like FOLFOX and the more recent study that was presented using the liposomal irinotecan 5-FU, although they have some benefit compared to fluoropyrimidine alone, but all in all, they're not really as efficacious as we see those drugs. But you have to get the right patient, and you have to really know what to expect in the side effect, and you have to know what to do when the side effects happen.